aquifers and watersheds. Understanding our water resources. A production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Episode 7, Phosphorus Outreach and the Fox Wolf Watershed. All right. Put down that chartreuse. We're back. In this episode, among many things, we're going to look at a natural cycle that really isn't as well understood as it ought to be, especially as it can have such a significant effect on watersheds. You've probably heard about the hydrological cycle and the carbon cycle. Well, the circulation of phosphorus through the Earth's systems can be thought of as a nutrient cycle, making it similar to other cycles such as those of nitrogen and sulfur, in that they are all vital for life as we know it. But in many ways, phosphorus is different. Unlike water, carbon, nitrogen, or sulfur, phosphorus doesn't naturally occur as a gas on Earth. So it only moves between liquids and solids, oceans and continents in the big picture. That movement is very fast in living creatures, yet millennially slow in the lithosphere. Phosphorus was the 13th element to be positively identified, and the first element to be discovered that was not known since antiquity. The discovery of phosphorus is credited to the German alchemist Hennig Brand in 1669. Brand plied his trade in Hamburg, the very same Hamburg which would be virtually destroyed by incendiary bombs made with white phosphorus in 1943. To say human beings have a love-hate relationship with phosphorus is, at times, a phenomenal understatement. In any case, if you look at the periodic table, you'll see phosphorus, P, grouped with three other elements, carbon, sulfur, and selenium, which are known as the polyatomic nonmetals. I bring this up mostly because I really wanted to say the polyatomic nonmetals, as it sounds like the name of some completely over-the-top new music act from Japan. However, the polyatomic bonding properties of these nonmetals allow them to create longer, linked chains of the same element, which makes them critical building blocks of organic matter. Phosphorus, like carbon, is one of the components of the DNA that encodes the genetic instructions used in the development and functioning of all known living organisms. Phosphorus seems to be everywhere these days. You even made some phosphorus today. We'll do the numbers for you in a moment. Nonetheless, though we all have to have phosphorus to function, too much phosphorus can be very bad for both organisms and ecosystems. But even if it's not quite like dancing about architecture, it's easy to get lost listening about chemistry. And going back and forth about too much, too little, liquids, solids, polyatomic, bonding, elements, and so on can make doing outreach about how nutrient cycles like that of phosphorus can affect human beings very challenging. But a few months back, I knew that Sea Grant outreach specialist Julia Nordyke would be coming down from Green Bay to headquarters here in Madison. So I arranged to flag her down in her truck so I could get someone knowledgeable to tell me more about it.
Hi, my name is Julia Nordyke. I work for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant, and I am the Water Quality and Coastal Community Specialist out of the Green Bay office. I particularly work in the Fox Wolf Watershed. So that actually is comprised of three sub-watersheds: the Wolf River watershed, which is northern central Wisconsin. We have the Upper Fox watershed, which is around the Lake Winnebago area, and then the Lower Fox watershed, which is from the De Pere down to the mouth of the river.
That sounds like a very large area, a good portion of the state then, right?
Yeah, it's a very large area, but about 50% of all that landmass is in agricultural use. About 25% is urban, and then the rest is natural forests and grasslands and so forth.
It's sometimes confusing for me because I know that agriculture is helped by having inputs of phosphorus and nitrogen fertilizers and things like that. But then it seems like phosphorus is a problem. Is this a two-edged sword? How does this all shake out?
The real big issue is that phosphorus is an important nutrient for plant growth. However, we have areas in agriculture that have been applying too much fertilizer. In the Fox Wolf watershed, there are a lot of dairy farms. Brown County is the highest density of dairy farms and CAFOs in the state. If you can imagine, thousands and thousands of cows producing a lot of manure every single day.
Okay, well, maybe you don't need to imagine that. But I should tell you that a CAFO is an EPA acronym for a concentrated animal feeding operation. To give you a Wisconsin-oriented example, a small CAFO based on mature dairy cattle would have less than 200 cows. A medium CAFO would have between 200 and 699 animals, and a large CAFO would have 700 or more cows. Unfortunately, because CAFO is an acronym, it's not allowed in Scrabble. Sorry. Back to Julia.
The general practice is to spread that manure on the fields as a fertilizer.
That sounds organic. Why would that be a problem? Is it just the number of animals, the concentration of it, overloading the watershed? What's going on?
Exactly. You spread a lot of manure on the fields, and the soil can actually only hold so much phosphorus. Once it's reached its capacity in phosphorus, the phosphorus leaches through the soil when it rains or the snow melts. So all that phosphorus is washed away down our rivers and streams and ends up in Green Bay, where it builds up, and then it fuels a lot of the algae that are ready to take up that excess phosphorus.
Does it change chemically? I know with the mercury cycle, it has to go through a couple chemical steps, or does it just basically stay the same element?
I don't know the details of the phosphorus cycle. I apologize.
This is where it fades into me explaining the details of the phosphorus cycle. Phosphorus enters the environment from inorganic phosphate rocks or organic phosphate mineral deposits found in the earth. Phosphate minerals, usually calcium phosphate, are essentially fossilized remains of organismal bone and guano. Weathering and erosion of rocks gradually releases phosphorus as phosphate ions, which are formed by one phosphorus atom bonding with one positively charged and three negatively charged oxygen atoms. Not all phosphate ions are soluble in water, but some are, and those are often the phosphates that get incorporated into the molecules essential for life, such as ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is important in the storage and use of energy. When plant materials and organic waste products decay through bacterial action, the phosphate in them is released and returned to the environment for reuse. Due to erosion and soil leaching, much of this phosphate ends up in watersheds. Here again, water plants and algae utilize the phosphate as a nutrient. Phosphate is a limiting agent in the growth of plants, however, so if not enough is present, plant growth is inhibited. Too much phosphate, and you'll have algae everywhere. Ultimately, most of the phosphate in water will precipitate out as insoluble phosphate. That phosphate will settle into deep sediments on the bottom and will only cycle through the environment again when those resulting rock formations are uplifted and erode once more. What are some of the challenges that you have to deal with in terms of helping people understand how to care for their watershed?
The biggest problem is people don't really realize that land use and landscape around them is what affects water quality. The watershed, as you've probably explained before, is an area of land where water seeps into the ground or runs off the landscape and then it goes into a common water body. So whatever practices we use on land affect what goes into the water. So that includes agricultural practices such as the phosphorus. There's also a lot of soil that runs off these lands, and that causes issues with sediment running into our waters and water clarity Also, we have urban areas. The water that runs down our streets ends up in our storm drains and then eventually into the rivers and lakes. That can carry with it leaf debris, trash, oil, other pollutants, and lawn fertilizers, which also contribute to phosphorus.
I've heard a lot about urban runoff. What are some of the challenges with that?
Everything that goes onto our streets ends up in a storm drain.
Everything?
Pretty much, I would say. When you drive down the street, most cars are continuously leaking oil or gasoline. When it rains, that water flushes all the pollutants that have collected on the roadways or driveways or roofs of our buildings, and they go down the storm drains, and then they end up in our lakes and rivers.
And what does that all mean for Green Bay once it all starts collecting there?
When the phosphorus enters the bay, it fuels algae growth. We have significantly large algae blooms there, which can actually raise levels of bacteria and cause harm to humans or pets in particular. You don't want your pets actually swimming or drinking lake water if you see green algae. It's what's called harmful algal blooms.
The algae is growing just like the plants in the field, right? Because phosphorus helps plants grow, and algae are plants, so they're growing in the water. Did I get that right?
Yeah, effectively, all the phosphorus that's running off our lawns and from the agricultural fields is fertilizing the bay.
A general rule of thumb is that it takes about 12 to 28 pounds of soil phosphorus above crop removal to raise the soil test phosphorus level 1 part per million. The amount of phosphorus required will depend on the initial soil test level, type of crop, and rate of crop removal, soil texture, clay minerals present, organic matter level, and tillage system. Knowledge of these relationships gives farmers greater flexibility to manage soil fertility and to negotiate with landlords and lenders. In Wisconsin, the optimum levels are generally about 25 to 35 parts per million, and it takes an average of 18 pounds of soil phosphorus to raise that by 1 part per million. I found this information from materials posted by the agronomists of the Potash and Phosphate Institute, who recommend monitoring soil through samples and tests every 3 years. Nutrient management planners can then determine appropriate rates for the best short-term and long-term economic benefits. The Institute also urges farmers to consider a 4 to 8 year approach in raising their soil phosphorus to optimum levels. Farmers can then evaluate whether they have been mining, maintaining, or building up their soil phosphorus. Managing their soils for optimum fertility will increase profit potential and help ensure that phosphorus levels don't limit the return on other crop production inputs, as adequate phosphorus increases nitrogen use efficiency. In addition, well-managed phosphorus will reduce the risk of crop damage in years with moisture and temperature extremes, and enhance the sustainability and stewardship of our land and water resources.
There are a lot of different ideas and solutions out there for farmers. There's what are called best management practices, and those include putting in buffer strips from your fields, bordering a ditch, a stream, or a river. Cover crops make a large difference. Farmers can seed in cover crops when they take out their corn, for example, and those cover crops come up through winter and they stabilize the soil, so there's not as much runoff, including the sediments and phosphorus. Some of those practices are solutions for farmers.
Are those cover crops things that they harvest or just something to keep the soil from washing away?
Actually, there are a couple different benefits to cover crops. Aside from stabilizing your soil, you can plant crops that are nitrogen fixing in the soil. In the spring, the farmer would just till them into the soil and they would become additional organic matter within their soil and provide the nitrogen fixing benefits to their future crops.
Is loss of topsoil an issue of concern in Wisconsin?
We have a ton of sediment running down off the fields into the watersheds. Particularly for Green Bay, this is an issue economically and ecologically speaking. Ecologically, the sediment actually causes issues with water clarity, and then submerged and emergent plant species in the water aren't able to grow because they can't receive enough sunlight. from an economic standpoint, there's a lot of dredging of the shipping canal.
That costs money.
It costs a lot of money. And this is a problem for many of the Great Lakes ports, actually. We spend millions of dollars every year to dredge our shipping canals of sediment.
Do you have any programs for planting trees along stream beds? I've heard that's one of the reasons Michigan's trout streams have come back, is that there's a lot of trees around the streams these days.
That would be something that I think Wisconsin, especially in more agricultural areas, should start to look at. On the Michigan side, where there has been a lot of reforested areas, that forest provides shade and it creates a buffer also for pollutants and nutrients from entering the streams. And so both of those create cooler and more oxygen-rich waters that trout really, really like.
We need a Johnny Appleseed to plant trees along rivers to create cool riparian environments so people can enjoy fishing more.
That will be particularly important with a changing climate. There is a wiki report, the Wisconsin Initiative for Climate Change. I believe by 2050, you know, a lot of the trout streams in southern Wisconsin won't be in existence anymore.
It won't be cool enough for a trout to handle it?
Yes.
Unless we plant lots and lots of trees.
I think we should start looking at management options, maybe potentially for central and northern Wisconsin, and how to actually prevent that from happening.
Why don't you tell me what you do with your job, and then you can tackle the challenges associated with it.
In the Fox River Valley, there are a lot of different people and groups working on water quality. One of the main drivers of water quality is the TMDL, which is the total maximum daily load. And that is an EPA standard for the amount of a pollutant that can be in a water body and still meet the Clean Water Act requirements. For the Fox River, we have two TMDL standards, one for phosphorus and one for total suspended sediments. We are working on outreach for that and trying to figure out how all these different groups can contribute to reducing those amount of pollutants for the entire watershed.
How's it been going? Are you seeing progress?
The TMDL regulations are just actually starting, and the regulations will be affecting permittees of wastewater. There'll be municipalities that have MS4 stormwater permits, municipal wastewater treatment facilities, and also industrial wastewater treatment plants that dispose of their water directly into the river. They are regulated through permits. Up and coming, when their permits are renewed, they will be required in their permits to meet TMDL regulations. So the biggest challenge there is the fact that a lot of the phosphorus and sediment that ends up in the bay actually comes from outside of those point sources. They come from the agricultural communities. So how do those point sources work with the non-point sources to reduce the overall sediment and nutrient loads in the bay?
Could you explain point source versus non-point source pollutants for our listeners?
Point source polluters are specific sites where you can identify the source of the pollution, such as maybe a paper mill or the outfall of wastewater treatment plants. And since they're easy to identify, they've been highly regulated since the Clean Water Act in 1972. Non-point source polluters are throughout the landscape, and it's very difficult to identify where the sources of nutrients and pollutants are coming from because it's a collection of all the different points. And it would take a lot deeper analysis to really figure out. It's more of a collective or accumulative impact of pollution into our water bodies.
What is the biggest challenge facing the Green Bay watershed today?
There are actually two large problems, I think. The first is the fact that there are so many different groups working on this very complicated issue, trying to make sure that everyone's working towards the same goal and has the same messaging is really important. And the second challenge, I think, is going to be for the permit holders that will be regulated by the TMDL to work with the non-point source polluters and figure out how to reduce nutrient loads, because they have to go up into the watershed and possibly pay farmers and other non-point source polluters to reduce their phosphorus contributions.
Speaking of phosphorus contributions, it's time to take a break and do the numbers. Though I'm not sure congratulations are in order, you've already produced some phosphorus today, and you did it while you were taking a break. That's right, 1 liter of adult human urine contains about 1.4 grams of phosphorus salts. which amounts to around a tenth of a gram of pure white phosphorus. Now that's scientific terminology. In everyday parlance, adult humans produce around 1.5 quarts of urine per day. And though the resulting 6/1000 of an ounce of phosphorus is by definition a trace amount, remember that they measure phosphorus in soil by parts per million. As it turns out, urine typically accounts for 70% of the nitrogen and more than half of the phosphorus and potassium found in urban wastewater flows, while making up less than 1% of the overall volume. With demand for phosphorus for use in fertilizer rising every year, and given the problems it can cause in watersheds, it starts seeming a bit wasteful flushing it all away. And sure enough, urine management systems have been developed over the last decade featuring source separation toilets, which isolate sterile urine from potentially harmful fecal matter. This urine can then be used in fertilizer. Our digestion strips our food down into basic minerals, and these minerals are in the ideal form for plants to absorb. The resulting fertilizers are superior and safe for gardens and for agriculture. So-called urine diversion systems have been successfully tested in Sweden and South Africa, are competitive in price with conventional luxury toilets, and have a very positive consumer response, particularly with organic farmers. Our need to reduce phosphorus loads on our watersheds may soon lead to increased use of such systems, and they could become an accepted part of resilient human societies in the future. And if you don't think things can change that fast, look at the Fox River.
Now, wasn't it at one time very polluted from paper mills and the like? Has it improved over the last few decades since the passing of this environmental legislation?
Yes. When the Clean Water Act was passed, at that point, the Fox River was highly contaminated with organic material, PCBs, and mercury. Those mainly came from the paper mills, which were point source polluters. Easy to identify, figure out where the pollution was coming from, easy to regulate. So there has been a massive undertaking starting, I believe, in 2009 to clean up PCBs out of the river. Since that time, they've actually built a riverside facility taking dredge material from the river, and they're funneling it through a large vacuum to this riverside processing facility where they clean the dredge material and they separate out the clean material, and then they truck that material to a disposal site. I just visited the facility, and they do approximately 200 truckloads of sediment a day.
And this is cleaned material. Now, how big are PCBs? Do they just strain the stuff through fine mesh, or what's that process?
PCBs like to stick to really tiny particulate matter. So this processing facility separates the larger grain, sand-like particles from the fine grain, and then they do a lot of testing of that dredge material. So the clean sediment is actually being used to build construction sites like Highway 41 reconstruction, whereas the sediment that has been found to be contaminated or have high levels of PCBs will be trucked to disposal facilities because it will not be able to be beneficially reused.
Any other last thoughts about the watershed before you head back upstate? Things you want to share about your job and your experience working with Green Bay? Is Green Bay better?
I think the PCB cleanup is a really exciting step forward for this area. Above the De Pere Dam, they've already started to see results with fish consumption levels. The DNR recently adjusted fish consumption advisories for fish above the De Pere Dam. So we're already seeing results, which is, I think, very exciting, seeing results sooner than they anticipated.
Okay, Juliet, well, thank you so much for sharing all the news about your hard work working on the Fox Wolf River watershed. Did I say that?
Yes, you did. It's not full.
This is Chris Bocast. Till next time. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Thanks for listening.